everyone. Welcome to Garden Fork Radio. You're here with Eric and Erin. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
I don't know if you remember, but Erin's been on the show a couple times. And full disclosure, Erin and I are both part of the Saturday 6 Troy Built Garden Blogger program. And they just renewed our sponsorship for a second year.
Great news, right?
Yeah. Yeah, new more equipment in my garage.
There we go.
And we're going to meet in Austin, actually. We just found out that we're going to Austin for a get-together to learn more about Troy Built. So that'll be fun.
That'll be great. Have you been there before?
No, I hear it's the like liberal town in conservative Texas, but that's all I know about it.
Yeah, that's about the sum total of my knowledge of it as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing what it's all about.
And they have South by Southwest there, and they have barbecue there. But I think they have barbecue everywhere in Texas. So
I think so, too. Yes.
So you are the perfect guest to the point that you're like a co-host now, because I just said, hey, you want to be on the show? And you sent me a list of 5 things to talk about. So I don't have to do any work.
Well, I'm happy to help out.
And your garden blog is starting to gain more traction, at least for what I can tell. And you have on there your garden predictions. And I wanted to hear about that.
Yeah. So I did a little post sort of with my predictions of what I think gardens are going to look like in 2016. And, you know, I should qualify this by saying I'm not a garden designer. I'm just a person who really likes the garden, and I happen to be a master gardener volunteer. But beyond that, I don't design other people's gardens. But I do spend a lot of time on Pinterest and other social media things. So I get and I'm very tuned into that whole gardening side of things from social media. So you start to see things that keep popping up. So I sort of came up with some ideas of what I think gardening is going to look like in 2016 and going forward, because of course nothing changes quickly in a garden. That's why gardening, I think, is a little more insulated from trends than some fashion and home decor is, because it takes a lot longer to develop a garden. So you can't just be flowing with the trends all the time.
Right. It's not overnight.
Exactly. It's a process, as they say. So here's some of the things that I think we're going to see for gardens this year and kind of going forward. So the first thing is, everybody I think knows, and everyone's clued in, that edible gardens are a big deal. Tons of new people are coming into gardening because they want to grow their own vegetables. They want to grow organic. They want to, you know, they want to eat the things that they grow. So I think that edible gardens are going to continue to be a big deal, but I think people are going to start working on making them prettier. And I think this goes along with people who turn front yards into gardens. And I think, you know, as people sort of develop as gardeners, they're going to start to understand that you don't have to pick pretty or practical. You can have both in a garden.
So this is kind of not a straight up vegetable garden. It's a garden planting that has edible food in it.
Yeah. Or a very pretty vegetable garden. You know, there's some you can arrange plants in a way that are absolutely, you know, beautiful, and it could be all entirely edible. But I think, you know, that's a broad concept of edible. Like, for instance, you know, nasturtiums, and there's a lot of other edible flowers. You need some of that color in there, and that all counts as edible. So I think you mix it all in together, and yes, you can eat everything in your garden, but it's just maybe a little prettier than just simple rows of things going on forever.
Cool. I actually really love when people plant their front yards into gardens, and I've seen them on different blogs, and some of them, they're a little too utilitarian, and some of them are really beautiful. And I wish the people that were just like, we're just going to dig up the yard. I'm like, you could think about your neighbors a little more.
You know? Right. Yeah. And I think that's it. I think as more and more people want to start reclaiming, and, you know, of course that's a big controversy in some cities about what you can do with your front yard, which is a little sad. I think you should be able to do what you want to do with your front yard. But, you know, as people sort of get into this, I think there will be a little bit more of that consideration, not just for your neighbors, but also if you're going to try to buck a trend and you have to go to your city and say, hey, I want to dig up my front yard, they're going to want you to make it pretty. And your argument can be very easy to make if you can say, hey, it'll be beautiful. It's just that I'm going to be able to eat what's in it or not eat what's in it. I mean, you can do whatever you want with your front yard, but I do think that, you know, incorporating edibles into that is fantastic.
Yeah, it's interesting here in the city. I mean, my frontage is 20 feet, and it's all cement, basically. But there are some people that will keep their front areas immaculate, and some of them dump their motorcycles in the front, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just interesting how in your suburban concept, 20 feet isn't really much, but when that's all you have, it's amazing what kind of energy people will put into it. And then some people just don't care. And there is some social pressure on the block. And I think there's social pressure also in like subdivisions. My parents' subdivision, an example of that, where the one neighbor built a large art installation in their yard with these multicolored sticks and stuff. And I don't think anyone could do anything about it except that the subdivision did not have any, are they called covenants?
Right.
They didn't have anything like that. And the town couldn't do anything either. So they're kind of stuck with this not great looking art installation.
Yeah. And, you know, and unfortunately what happens then is then people don't like that. And then cities rush to create, you know, laws that, you know, and ordinances that are, you know, maybe a little broad based and don't incorporate, you know, ideas that might be very beautiful, all because one person did something that is perhaps very personal to their taste, specific to their taste.
So are you going to add in edibles into your ornamental areas or?
I've been doing that for several years now. Last year I grew an entire garden full of red boar kale because it's so, I frankly grew it as an ornamental. Because it is a gorgeous plant. I grew it all over the place. And we did eat some of it. I mean, really, I was honestly growing it more for its ornamental properties, but we ate plenty of it as well. And I love incorporating herbs into the regular garden because I think they have really interesting texture. I mean, honestly, I do it a lot of times for their ornamental properties, but it's great to have the edible mixed in there too. I put nasturtiums everywhere. I have a chive hedge around one garden, which is both ornamental, ornamental, practical, and edible because we eat chives all the time. It also helps to keep rabbits and stuff out a little bit. So
yeah, I think alliums in general will deter insects.
Yes.
We don't have too many rabbits in either place. The coyotes eat most of them upstate, so that's
handy.
I like chives because they're easy to grow and they grow like weeds and they self-seed. And if they get in where you don't want them, they pull out really easily.
Yeah, they're perfect. They're a perfect plant. And I love letting them flower. I think they're beautiful when they get a little flower on them. I mean, if you don't like the flower, chop it off. It's no big deal. Chop them, you know. I probably chop mine down to the ground at least once a summer and just refresh everything. You know, when they get a little spent and floppy, chop them all down. They regrow in 3 weeks and you got your chive hedge back.
You can eat the flower heads too.
Mm-hmm. Have you eaten them?
Yeah, I put them in salads.
And do you pull them apart to do that?
I just kind of whack them in half, but you could put the whole, I mean, it's not a very big, it depends on the chive, I guess, but you know, it kind of blends into the salad and adds this kind of sharp, oniony flavor to it. And you're like, oh, I'm eating a flower, you know?
I'll have to try that because I love throwing flowers in salads. I think it's pretty too. So I'll try that this year.
Now, the red boar kale, is that the kind with the green leaf and the red stem?
No, that's full on purple. The whole thing is purple.
Okay.
So, yeah. And it got very, I mean, last year when I grew them, there were some that were easily 4 feet tall. I had to actually stake them from flopping over.
Did the deer get into those at all? Or?
Very interestingly, when I grow kale in my garden, nothing touches them until after a very hard frost. So once there's a very hard frost, I think what happens is it's a sugar thing.
Yep.
And, you know, then for whatever reason, they're not interested in it all before then. So everything is fine until there's a very hard frost. And then the deer and my dogs will go nuts for them.
My dogs eat string beans and cherry tomatoes.
Oh, yeah. My dogs love vegetables. They love going that we say, do you want to go to the garden? And they think that's great. They'll help themselves if I'm not careful.
Yeah, someone in my family thinks it's cute that they eat all the vegetables in my garden. So,
not so cute all the time. So you want me to go on with a few other gardening trends that I think we're going
to
see?
Yeah, it's good for you to keep us on point because I'm not good at that. So
okay, so the next two are, I think, kind of go hand in hand. I think gardens are going to get a little bit more formal, and I think white gardens are going to be very hot. And these two things go hand in hand because if you start looking at very popular landscape pictures on Pinterest, or I often go to Houzz. That's Houzz.com.
Oh.
The gardens that people are putting in, you know, new houses are very square. There's not a lot of, that I see, sort of flowy cottage style gardens. There's a lot of square. There's a lot of boxwood hedges. Boxwood is the hottest shrub that there is right now.
Wow. I thought that was such an old plant.
Yeah. And it is, but it's, I think it's gotten this huge resurgence because you see boxwood balls and boxwood squares and boxwood hedges, and there's boxwood everywhere. The whole world is hot for boxwood. And then what you see is a framework of, you know, usually a boxwood hedge with a whole bunch of white plants in it, often hydrangeas, or some people do tulips or roses or things like that. But all to me, to my eye, these are pretty formal looks with, and there's sometimes some curves in it, but I think it's a very limited color palette of mostly greens and whites. And I think that's going to continue to be a pretty hot thing.
Do they make white marigolds? Did I see that?
I think they do. Yes. Do that, they? Yeah. As the people who make the plants.
That's what I could plant.
Yeah. Right. There you go. So, I mean, I don't know that that's necessarily, I can appreciate that look and I think it's certainly suitable, but to me, I'm a color person.
Yeah.
And I could see having a section of my garden look like that, but I don't know that I would personally be satisfied with such a limited color palette, because I just like to go kind of nuts with the color palette. I will say they're beautiful gardens though. And once you start limiting your color palette that much, I think it's really important that you draw on texture. So some of these white gardens have beautiful ornamental grasses that have kind of a white streak in them. Yep. And things like that. And that helps add to that texture. So they're very interesting gardens, but it's definitely a sort of a restrained kind of thing.
I really love ornamental grasses, and I don't really have a place for them in my yard. And I'm going to have to work on that, because I think ornamental grasses can go from bamboo to almost wheat, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll have to find some that are cold hardy.
Oh, yeah. We can find you some for sure. Because, and that's interesting. That is another one of my trends, is that grasses are going to be a big deal going forward. I don't think that grasses ever were out, so to speak, but I think more and more, a lot of these gardens that you're seeing, especially very popular public gardens, are drawing a lot on grasses. And almost a prairie-like look seems to be getting very popular. I mean, if you go to the garden, the Lurie Garden in Millennium Park in Chicago, which is an absolutely amazing place to go at any time of the year, it has a very prairie-ish feel to it. And there's these grasses that, you know, grasses have this, many of them have a very ethereal feel to them. And it's very light and airy, and there's this great movement. And I personally love that in garden design, but I'm seeing more and more pictures that incorporate that, as well as, you know, some that are there a little bit more for structure, which sort of fall in that bamboo category, or some of the miscanthus grasses are a little straighter. Carl Forrester, you know, kind of is probably like the most popular ornamental grass, and it sort of grows straight up. And it's just great shape. And I leave it standing all year and then chop it off in spring. So it's great in winter. But I think we're going to see a lot more grasses, and I think there is a spot for ornamental grasses in any garden or any yard, frankly.
Sweet. I mainly have ferns and goldenrod. So that's because they just come up.
Sure. We can work them in there. I predict you will have some ornamental grasses.
They're going to show up in a box
in there by the end of this summer. There you go. There you go. Then my last gardening trend is that I think that succulents are going to be not as popular as they have been in the past. Now, I'll preface this by saying, when I posted this, I did a blog post about these trends, and a lot of people from California kind of jumped on me, and they said, succulents will always be popular. And so I think they have a good point. And the point is, if you're in a place where you really have major water restrictions and it's very sunny and very warm, succulents will always be popular in those places, because they are easy to grow plants in places like that. But succulents in the past few years have become, I think somewhere along the line, someone said, succulents are great are no-brainer plants. You don't have to do anything to them. Just buy them and they grow. And no plant is like that. That's a big fallacy. So what happens is people get succulents and then they kill them. And if you're not growing it in a place where they're sort of from and natural to that area, there's a little more work. You can overwater them. You can listen, it's possible to underwater a succulent. They're not magic, you know. And I think succulents, there's a wide variety of them, but they have a pretty specific look. Yep. And I think you're going to see people kind of moving away from that in places where it's not a natural thing that really works in yards, like in drought-stricken California.
Do you have any succulents in your yard? Or
I do have some succulents. I like succulents ground covers. And I have a couple of those that kind of run around and do their thing. And I like them. They're great. They fill in areas and you can rip them out by the handful in the places where you don't want them. And
do they overwinter well?
They do. So most of them do. And I have a couple other succulents too. Some sedums, which are in the succulent family, that are very pretty and they all do well. They are relatively easy, but some of the more exotic looking succulents, I mean, these are pretty, the ones that I grow are pretty basic ones. But once you get into some of sort of these exotic ones with these great blue gray leaves, you know, that's not necessarily an easy care plant and it's not going to overwinter well in my garden for sure. It would have to be grown in a pot and, you know, then you get, I have too many diva plants.
Yeah. I've never heard that term before.
So, you know, I have to, oh yeah, I have a lot of divas and I don't mind having those and I'm happy to put the time and effort into taking care of plants that are really special to me, but not every plant in the garden can be like that. Some of them just have to be okay doing their own thing and be independent.
Everyone, I'm wondering if you would consider becoming a monthly supporter of Garden Fork Radio and GardenFork.tv. We've made it really easy to do so. We've started a Patreon campaign, and you choose a dollar amount every month that you would like to contribute to Garden Fork. The suggested dollar amount is $3 a month. That's less than a dollar a show, a buck a show, as Rick calls it. It's about $36 a year, so that's like a magazine subscription, basically, is how I think about it. If you're interested, there's a link in the show notes here. If you're listening on an iPhone in the podcast app, just tap on the Garden Fork Radio logo of this episode, and it will show the show notes, and there's a link in there. Or go to patreon.com/gardenfork. That's patreon.com/gardenfork. There's also a link on every page of our website. If you consider that, that would be really cool. Appreciate that. You can also support Garden Fork by using our Amazon shopping link, which is on our website. You can also go to gardenfork.tv/Amazon, and that, if the technology is working, should take you to Amazon as well. All right, thank you. So this kind of segues into what we also wanted to talk about is actually planning for seed starting. And I kind of get excited about this because it's January 20th here and we still don't have any snow on the East Coast, but we're supposed to get a big wampin' storm this weekend. And that'll allow me some time to go through the catalogs and, of course, overbuy seeds. What about you?
I completely overbuy seeds. Every year I say I'm not going to do it and I'm going to have a specific plan and I'm going to go through the seeds that I didn't use last year. And I don't know why I bother even wasting my breath saying that because I don't do it ever. I always buy too much.
What's your process for seed starting?
So, you know, I'm kind of new to seed starting. I never used to grow anything from seeds save for maybe beans and peas. Everything else, I bought plants, started plants. And then in the past few years, I've gotten more and more into it. And I really kind of went whole hog on it last year. And I loved it. I found it so enjoyable. And I love being able to garden in some fashion when it's snowing outside.
Yeah.
So, you know, once I sort of tried to rein myself in and figure out the seeds, I got myself a little system. Now I have a heated seed mat, which helps a ton.
Yep.
Most seeds don't need light to germinate. Some do, some don't. So it's important to know which ones do and which ones don't. But a lot of them don't need light to germinate. So I set up my heated seed mat in the basement and stick them on there till they germinate. And then I bring them upstairs and I've got two grow lights that are, these are just shop lights. I mean, I think they were sold. I think I bought them as grove lights, but there's no difference between that and a shop light. And so I've got, I can have probably four trays at a time sitting under lights. And then I just kind of keep moving them. And I have a, I make a spreadsheet of all this. This is really, I know this is so geeky. So I make a spreadsheet of all the seeds I want to grow, when they should be started, what the germination time is on them, what any other information I need to know about the germination, like do they need light to germinate, do they need a specific heat to germinate, whatever, when they can be planted out, etc. So I have all that information in front of me in one place, so I don't have to keep looking it up for every plant. And so that hangs on my cabinet in the basement where I start most things. So I also started using soil blocks last year. Are you familiar with those?
Yeah, I've never used them. I was curious.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. It's a little fuddly. So soil blocks, so people know, you can buy a little, it's a little like soil press, and you mix up a special seed starting mix, and it has some, is it called coir? C-O-I-R.
Is yeah, coir. It's the coconut coir. Fiber.
Yeah, coconut fiber in it. That makes up some of it. And there's some regular seed starting mix. And I put in a little bit of earthworm castings. And I don't know the exact recipe off the top of my head. But all of these things. And then a lot of water. And what you end up with is a mix that you can form into blocks. And I have a soil block maker. And it makes four blocks. And it's 2-inch square blocks. And you jam it all in there and you press it down and you pop out these little soil blocks. And I grow everything in those with those sitting in a tray. And what's nice about that is that the roots will air prune themselves, meaning that when you grow something in a small pot or in a small seed, it'll start, you know, the roots start circling when they run out of room in the thing.
Yes.
They won't do that here. They'll stop when they reach the edge of your soil block. They'll stop. And that's when you know it's time to repot that. And then the repotting process is great. You just pick up the whole soil block, stick it in a small little 3-inch pot, you know, like you would normally pot something on.
Yep.
So I love it. I thought it was great. I liked it much better than little seed starting trays with individual modules.
Yeah, I use seed starting trays, but I have a hard time sometimes popping them out of the individual things.
Exactly. So this sort of limits that from happening. And I find too with the, you know, with the 2-inch blocks, you're able to keep most things in there for a good amount of time before you have to pot them on. Sometimes, you know, if your seed starting modules are too small, you have to pot things on quite early. And sometimes that's almost too early to move them on to a big pot. And I'm only potting things on once before they go in my garden. I'm not repotting things two or three times. They get one shot. So.
Okay.
No, it's tough loving my seed starting land, let me tell you.
Well, gardening is that way. I mean, you kind of have to make some decisions. So
exactly, there's only so much time, and you know the problem is that I have outgrown my seed starting habit has outgrown the room in which I do this all in, and which is sort of doubles as our home office. And I have card table. It gets real bad in there. It's definitely more like a greenhouse. And every year I say it's time to figure out a greenhouse situation, because no one should really live with that many plants in one room for a couple of months.
Well, cool. I'm going to experiment this year. I've always been read in books that to plant peas, you have to direct seed them in the soil and they don't transplant. And I'm going to grow some from seed in the house and transplant them into the garden and see what happens this year.
I did that last year for the first time as well, because one of the problems is that, you know, we have kind of a weird spring. I bet your springs are not much different. We don't get sort of a gradual warming. We kind of get a, hey, spring's here if it's going to be spring. And so what'll happen is when it's warm enough, when it's the time of year when you want to be planting seeds, sometimes that soil is not workable yet. And so by the time the soil is workable and you get that seed in, you're so far behind. And now I'm getting peas in the beginning of July. Well, peas don't want to grow when it's that hot.
Yep.
So I think, and I did not have a problem transplanting them last year. I'll be interested to hear what kind of results you have. But to me, it really wasn't a problem. They didn't seem to fight it much. So I'm going to do the same thing again, because otherwise I don't think they get it. I can get them in early enough otherwise.
Yeah, I love, it's just, I love peas, and of course the Labradors eat them, so.
Whatever the Labradors want.
Yeah.
Let's have our priorities.
As usual, I keep an eye on my friends, and I've been seeing some of your posts online, and you're doing some more renovating, and it sounds like there's some issues.
There's always issues with renovating, and the sooner I learn that lesson, the happier a person I will be. As you know, we did a huge renovation on our house 4 or 5 years ago now, where we ripped the top of our house off and put it back on again. That was a big one, and it, you know, like any renovation, I think, you know, what happens is you sort of forget all the bad things, and you're left with the finished product, and you're really happy with it. So you renovate again then. So we just have a couple of rooms in our house to sort of finish up, and then literally we have touched every room in our house. But we've been working on sort of that room that I mentioned that we use as sort of our home office slash den kind of room. And all we really are doing in there is we we purchased a house. And part of the deal with that house was that all of the walls were covered with this horrible, thick texture, and it was awful, and dust got in there, and it was ugly and everything else. So we just needed that room re-drywalled from the wainscoting up, and then we put on a new wood ceiling, and that's it. And so this time around, you know, one of the things that happened was they put down red rosin paper on the wood floors to protect the wood floors, which was great. Yep. We were happy that they did that. Except when red rosin paper gets wet, it stains. So when we pulled up that red rosin paper, we had pink floors.
Wow.
So now we're dealing with that. And it's, you know, it's a bummer of a situation all the way around. I mean, it's clearly not our fault. It's clearly nothing the contractor intended to do.
Yep.
But, you know, we're stuck in this situation in which it's like, you know, I don't think anyone likes to have to get into sort of uncomfortable conversations, but, you know, who's going to pay for fixing that floor? And I don't think it should be me, and he doesn't want to do it. And, you know, this contractor relations is something that I continue to sort of struggle with sometimes.
Were the floors, it's a wood floor. Is it like a oak plank floor? Was it treated polyurethane or anything? Or
yeah, it was a finished oak floor that, you know, we had with those floors refinished, I don't know, a while ago, with just, you know, satin polyurethane on top of it. But they're bleached floors, so they're very light. And so, you know, on a dark floor, I don't think you ever would have noticed that this dye had transferred through to the floor. But on a very light floor, sure enough, there's pink floors.
You know, I bet a light sanding would take that out.
Well, we had... we actually had the flooring company come out today just to give us, because one of the things we thought about was maybe it's only in that top layer finish.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty easy fix then. You can just kind of scuff that up and then put on a coat of finish. And unfortunately, that doesn't, according to them, that's not the case. They suggest that it's a full on refinishing job. Of course, that's the flooring company saying that. So we're going to get another quote from the other person, but you know, it's interesting to me. I've learned a lot about working with contractors, and you know, it's different, I think, in renovations because you're trying to preserve the parts of the house that are not currently being renovated.
Yep.
And as a homeowner, you go, oh gosh, be careful about that. Be careful about that. And they have to balance being careful with whatever with getting the job done. So I actually, ironically, here I am kind of complaining, and I don't mean to do that, but I feel like I've gotten a little bit looser about some of the things that happen that I think are just things that happen in construction. Like there's paint that chipped off because they whacked it with a board in a hallway that was not at all part of the project, or where they taped stuff off, some of the paint peeled up, or there's little things like that. And I do feel like I've learned to understand those things happen with any kind of construction, and you better steel yourself for that because it just is what it is. But I do feel sometimes, and I'm hoping you can kind of speak to this from the contractor side, that sometimes you think, gosh, don't they realize this stuff is going on, or can't they acknowledge or clean up a little better or something? So that's sort of the frustration that I think comes with renovating.
Yeah, it's a tough one. From my experience, running a small crew is incredibly hard, and it is hard to find, you know, first you're the primary contractor and you know how it should be done, but you can't do it all yourself. So you need to hire some guys to work with you, and trying to find those people that have that same mindset as you do is really difficult. And once you find them, the trick is to keep them busy constantly. And that's really hard to do. It's hard to book 5 or 6 days a week, you know, every week ongoing.
Yeah.
And I used to cover everything with rosin paper too. And we got things wet and I didn't notice that. But a lot of the floors we were working on were darker and also use an oil-based polyurethane, which might be a little more impermeable. Thinking about that.
Yes, it's great. Our floors are water-based polyurethane.
It's great that you're realizing that, yeah, there's going to be some dings and stuff, because I have a friend who is having a gut renovation just started the other day, and she's like, oh, I want to save these pieces of wood. I'm like, then get them out of the way.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm like, no, get them out of the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good advice, and I feel like I've gotten a little better about that stuff. I will also say, you know, I tend to complicate these projects because the way we do these projects is I believe in sort of DIYing everything I can DIY. So since for this project, I have done every single bit of painting involved in this project. And, you know, that slows up their process. And some contractors will not even work with you if that's your deal. They're like, listen, I got to get in and get out, and I don't know where you're going to be at that. So I appreciate contractors who are willing to work with a homeowner who wants to, or, you know, in some cases, you know, has to, in order to make the budget for a renovation work, I have to take on some of the projects. So, you know, I appreciate that. And I know that sort of complicates that issue even further for them. So, you know, I try to be, you know, sort of relaxed about some of these things and go with it. But I just think, you know, there's stress in a renovation and it comes out in these little things that normally you look back and go, well, that was dumb. Why would you care?
Yeah, it's a tough one because I've had people like, oh, well, like, can I do this and this? And I'm like, no, we're going to steamroll through this thing.
Yeah, and that's just it. And that's the thing. I will say that, you know, I tried to do that with our big renovation. And there were times when they said, we got to keep going. So if you're not going to have that done in the next 2 hours, we got to keep moving. And I understood that. So this time, like, for instance, like I said, we put up wood plank ceilings. He was very nice. I said, get me that wood in plenty of time to get it painted, which he did. So I was able to paint all of those wood ceilings in the basement before they were installed, which is the only way to do ceilings. If anyone who's ever painted a ceiling knows, especially a wood plank ceiling in which a brush is involved, oh my God, you have to do it before it's installed. So they were great. And I stayed up lots of late nights just getting it done because I didn't know when they'd need them, but I wasn't going to be the one holding it up. So I know I have learned to get better about that, but I appreciate too that they're willing to. I mean, it was an extra trip out for them to run out and bring the wood ceilings out. So, you know, that's helpful.
So it is helpful. Sometimes I've had, like, I would buy paint and I would get a discount on the paint from the paint company, and the clients would say, well, are you getting a discount on the paint? I'm like, yeah, I am. And I'm charging you retail. And they're like, well, we should only pay for cost for the paint. I'd be like, fine, I'm going to charge you for delivering it.
Right.
And then they would stop. I don't know. You're getting me on a tangent here, but some of them are like, I need to make money here. You know?
And, you know, and I think, and that's why I actually feel badly about what has happened with these floors on this particular situation, because the quote that we got was very reasonable. And this guy we've not worked with him before, but other people recommended him to us. He's a very nice guy. He's a young guy too. So I think his quote was reasonable and I liked everything about it. And I know that he's going to end up eating the cost of these floors because I just don't feel like it's right. And I told him, I said, go back to the company who you bought your paper from and ask them to help you cover this cost on this stuff. And I don't know if he will or not, but I feel bad about it. And I don't like doing that. But at the same time, I know, you know, I didn't do anything wrong, so I shouldn't have to pay to refinish those floors. So, and you know, and the other thing is if those floors were in rough shape to begin with, I don't think I would care about it because I'd be like, you know what? They needed refinishing anyway, so it's not his problem. It doesn't matter. But they were in like perfect shape, so it's a bummer.
Typically with any kind of work in a room, you start from the ceiling and work down because paint, nails, hammers, everything falls down. So if you damage the floor, oh, we're going to sand the floor at the end anyway.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing I've run into is we're working in a house and we put the blue masking tape on floors, you know, to mask off molding or to put down rosin paper or something. And then like 4 days later, you pull up the blue tape and you pull up the polyurethane.
That's interesting that you mentioned that because when I talked to the flooring company today, they one of the things they put in their little thing was, you know, don't put any tape on the floor at all. And we had no problems with that, but it's interesting that you mentioned that because clearly that's something that happens from time to time.
So I put that, I used to put that in the project agreement. And I'm going to go like, look, you know, we're, and what I discovered was when people did quickie, a lot of stuff we worked on was just, had just been bought. They just bought the apartment and wanted it painted. And the seller would do this quickie polyurethane job with the squeeze on polyurethane, kind of like a mop and glow polyurethane. Sure. And that would rip up in 3 seconds. And so I used to just say, look, we're going to tape the floors. And if it's a bad polyurethane job, it's not my fault.
Yeah.
You know, they now make a rosin paper. It's a more heavy duty construction paper. It's almost like a cardboard that comes in a roll. And I can't remember what it's called. It's more expensive, but it'll take like a drop of a hammer. You know, you can drop a hammer on it and it won't ding the floor underneath.
They actually use some of that. And unfortunately, I can't come up with it's builder something. I can't remember what the name of it is right now either. Builder board, I think is what it's called.
Yep.
And they use that in sort of the walkways, and that's great stuff. I mean, that was fantastic. They use that in the heavily trafficked areas, and that's fantastic stuff. I would recommend. I'm sure it's expensive for contractors to use that, but boy, that is an excellent product.
It's cheaper than a floor.
That's right. You bet. Let me ask you a quick question. So, since you're coming at this from the contractor's point of view, what do you think is the secret in doing a renovation in someone's house, you know, from a contractor's point of view, what's the secret in making sure it goes smoothly and keeping everybody happy, even when you know, you got to make money and the homeowner's stressed? Like, what is the secret to a happy ending?
The client has to be ready to pay for it. If they're trying to cheap out, I won't do the job.
Yeah.
Because I actually will, you know, I used to do an estimate and then I would add like 30% onto it because I know they will change something.
Mm-hmm.
And like one time we had keys to the doorknob of the house, but not the deadbolt. And so they deadbolted the house and left for work. And we get to the, you know, they left when we got to the job before, you know, they left and we were like, okay, we can't get into your house. Oh, well, I'm at work. I'm like, well, I'm not going to eat a day of payroll.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And to them it was like, oh, no, oh, I'm sorry. And I'm like, well, no. You know, I have to pay these day rates here. So, but it's just, you have to be prepared that it's going to cost more than you think. And by the end of it, you might not like your contractor.
Yeah. Yes. I think that's true. And I think what's interesting about that is that we left that large renovation with a little bit of distaste in our mouth with our contractor. And now looking back, you know, he did a great job. And there were things I didn't like how he did some of the billing, and there was a few other things that I felt were not great. But looking back, I'm like, well, I would hire him again. He was great, but it did end a little bit on a sour note. You know, he was over time and way over budget, and but we also that we were first time renovators, so I think we estimated in our head 10% over on a huge renovation, which was ridiculous. You know, I mean, I think we ended up 20% over, and we were probably lucky to escape with only 20% over.
Yeah, and you're running these surprises. You open up a wall and you're like, uh-oh, what's that? You know?
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that happened with this house. We, you know, our house is ancient. And so when we were getting some bids for this, I said, I'm going to warn you, and I want you to include this in your quote. You know, this house is not square. There's not a square wall in this house. There's not a level floor in this house. God knows what may or may not have lived in these walls at some point. I just know there's surprises abound when you start ripping open walls in this house. So I said, so factor that in to, you know, to your quotes.
I've opened up walls and found sewer pipes wrapped in duct tape.
Oh.
And you're like, all right, you got to fix this before I put the wall back in, you know? It's just stuff like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think you're right. But doesn't that go back to, I forget what they say, but isn't there some saying about you can have it quick, cheap, or well done, and you have to pick two.
Fast, cheap, good. Pick two.
Yeah. I think that's true.
Wow. That was action-packed.
was action-packed.
I was curious a little bit about this. I want to just harken back a bit to the wood ceilings. Is that like a plank, or are they tongue and groove ceilings, or is it a big piece of plywood or something? Or
it's so they call it car siding. That's when they bought it, go to the lumber store and buy it. It's a tongue and groove plank ceiling, and what it is it's two pieces. Each piece is actually appears to be two boards. They're about 4 inches wide with a V groove down the middle, and then they're tongue and groove, so of course they all fit together. And once you get it up, it looks like individual 4 inch wide planks. If you flip it over, it's an 8 inch wide plank, and you can also, that's finished on that side, so you can also put them up as 8 inch wide boards too.
Wow.
And they're pine. Some of them have a lot of knots, so that's one of the things that when I finished them, you got to make sure you seal up those knots really, really well, or else you're going to have, tannins leaking through your white paint job in no time. But, so it takes a little bit of time to finish those because they do have those knots in them. But, we've got that through the rest of the house on the ground floor. So we just wanted, the main reason we did it was just to keep it consistent on the ground floor of the house.
Wow. And also for knotty woods like that, I use like a super heavy duty primer, like Zinsser Bond Coat or something.
That's exactly what I did. I puttied all those knots and then two coats of Zinsser primer over the top, just to be rather be safe than sorry. And then I actually, if there were any knots that you could still see after two coats of paint or two coats of primer, I kind of went back and sort of spot treated those knots as well.
It comes
Hopefully
in a spray can.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You probably had a headache after that.
Mm. Yes, you have to be a little careful about the fumage situation.
Well, cool. I think that makes a podcast, don't you?
I think it makes probably a long podcast.
No, this is fine. We've been talking for a bit. That's people probably arrive at their destination in their car, so that's cool.
Good. I'm glad. Well, I hope we were able to entertain them for a brief moment there.
So I forgot to tell them all about your website and everything. You want to tell them?
Sure. I have a blog. It's called The Impatient Gardener, and you can catch that at theimpatientgardener.com. And I cover gardens and a little bit of renovations. It's sort of the stuff that's going on at my house right now.
And your two big dogs.
And I have two big dogs, and they make occasional appearances on the blog.
I love it.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. Well, thanks for listening. Thanks for taking the time to download the show. Always appreciate that. If you want to have any comments, the email address is radio@gardenfork.tv, and you can talk to myself and Aaron as well. And also, if you want to get our email newsletter, you can send an email to news@gardenfork.tv, and it'll come back with a link and get you to sign up. So thanks, everyone, and thank you, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me again. Mm-hmm.